Welcome to the conference. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the call over to Mr. Peter Angert. Please go ahead, sir.
Thanks very much, and good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining us, and hopefully this will be our last call, but no promises. We've learned that lesson before. I'm going to ask Lindsay to do a very quick roll call, and then we'll turn this over to Greg and Sally so that we can move along with our agenda and try to get through all of the items as quickly as we can. Lindsay?
Okay. Greg Meyer?
Here.
Sally Tyler?
Here.
Leah Binder? Patrick Brennan? Tejal Gandhi?
Here.
Christine Goschel? Kevin High? Cynthia Hone?
Here.
Helen Lau?
Here.
Catherine McDonough? John Morley?
Here.
Deborah Nadsom? Martha Radford? Ansel Riley?
Here.
Diane Ryderick? Doran Schneider? Philip Schneider?
Here.
Eric Tanglos? Michael Victoroff?
Here.
Okay, Greg and Sally?
Sorry, does that give us enough for a quorum?
It does.
Okay, and Diane Redrick sent some comments in as well, which we have recorded dutifully. So, Greg and Sally, please.
So I was just saying earlier to those on the phone that I'm a bit under the weather, so I'm going to let Sally lead the beginning of this. She has to leave a little bit early, so I will be jumping in then. But we do hope to get through the remaining issues in terms of some of the definitions and review of the glossary and clean up a few last questions on some of the safe practices.
Okay, great. And everybody, even though we don't have a full house today, I just wanted to take 1 minute to thank everybody for participating. If this is indeed our last phone call, I very much have appreciated working with all of you, and I know, or at least I believe, that nobody's getting any combat pay for participating on NQF committees, or maybe hopefully you get some pats on the back at some point for doing some good work. But I know it's something that everybody just has to make time for in their own professional and personal lives. So I've really appreciated your willingness to jump in and do it. So we can get started with, I guess we'll start with the glossary. That's the first thing we're going to look at. Hopefully people got a chance to look at the glossary that Lindsay sent out to everyone. Do we have comments, anybody's comments on them?
Hi, Sally. This is Cynthia Haynes. I do have a concern about the definition of authorized.
Okay.
I think that that's a difficult definition to work from for in-house counsel or general counsel for any physician's office. I would suggest that we go along the lines of a guardian or other individuals having the ability to consent for the minor or incapacitated person or other person so designated by them to discharge that patient to, or something along those lines.
Okay,
I jotted something down. I'd be happy to send it to you.
Okay, just to make sure we're all clear. So what we sent out to you, authorized, means having official permission, right? And that's what you have a problem with. Do you think it's not sufficient?
That's correct.
Right.
I don't know what the official is, and I'm not sure what the permission is.
Okay.
What about it's Peter, and I think that's a very good point, and it's partly why we've got it highlighted and flagged. And later on, it's unauthorized is sort of the mirror image of this same discussion. But what about, we do not have surrogate or designated surrogate in here, as near as I can tell. Does that help bridge this, or is it different terminology entirely that's better?
I think that it goes, from the working folks in the floor in the hospital, the questions that I got as an attorney was, who by law can consent for this person? Is it an official guardian as appointed by the court or one recognized by the law such as a parent? And then that person would be the one who kind of directed not only the medical care, but to whom, you know, who the visitors could be, to whom the patient could be discharged. So I think that from the standpoint of the hospital, people, the individuals who can legally consent for the minor is easier to understand than surrogate, which gets confusing and they start using, you know, with bioethical issues.
Okay. Well, if you could offer some language options that you think are easier both at the bedside as well as meaningful within the court side, that would be helpful.
I sure will do that.
Thank you.
Okay, so that will be included in the draft that's sent out to us, right?
Cynthia's
comments? Okay.
Yeah, I'll type it right here in the check chat while we're talking.
Okay, you can put it in now. Great. Okay. Any other reactions to the authorized definition?
Under high alert medicines on page B2, this is Phil Schneider, we have high alert medicines, and one of the ones that I don't see on that list, and I know it can't be an exhaustive list, but it's one that really is a big problem, and more so even maybe in the institutional setting than warfarin, is heparin. And I know we did cover insulin, which is important to have on there, which is good. I don't know whether that makes any sense or not, but that's, you know, with the Dennis Quaid thing and a number of errors from floor stock heparins that look alike and so forth, has been an ongoing, pervasive, and difficult to resolve problem. So if I had to list three, heparin would have been one of them, as opposed to
probably say anticoagulants in general.
Or anticoagulants, that might be good too. Yeah.
I agree with anticoagulants in general.
Okay. There's a number of them out there.
So. Yeah. This is Michael. There's maybe 40 or 80 that are on the website of the ISMP.
Right.
And I wouldn't pick out two or three.
Right.
I think the decision here is whether we're going to accept the ISMP's list of high alert medications or whether we're going to say that they include those as examples of high alert medications and possibly some others. I think I think the most convenient thing would be to simply inherit the list and to adopt it by reference.
And take out the sentence, examples of high alert medicines include entirely?
Yeah, I've rewritten maybe almost all of these, but under this one, what I would propose is high alert medications, those medications that appear on the ISMP list of high alert medications, see www, whatever the hell.
I don't think it hurts to have a few examples.
I agree with Sally. I think it would be nice to have a few examples and then have the link.
I agree with that as well. I think you need some context here because this is what all the people will look at, but I think the website is a great ref.
This is Peter, and I tend to agree, although other organizations use the terminology high alert medications as well, specifically the Joint Commission and others. So, there's a balancing act here, but certainly there are more than just the few that we've got listed as examples. So providing direction is a good idea.
Well, I didn't go back to the table. I'm trying to search right now in the table and see where this appears. And whether or not it helps us or hurts us to limit the list to those that have been officially designated. Maybe someone else knows which. Oh, wait, here it is. Or any other high alert medication. So now I'm in Event 5, Care Management Event A, and this event is intended to capture occurrences in which the overdose of heparin and any other high alert medication. See, why are we even defining it?
Well, I don't have any problem with the high alert medication. This is Stan. I think I have a problem probably just listing heparin and could say anticoagulants there, and then put the link.
I'm fine with that.
Sure.
I mean, heparin is a lot more common of the medication error than the IV digoxin, for example. I'm not trying to split hairs. I'm just saying it's an example that would resonate to people a lot because it's very commonly used, and there are system problems with relation to floor stock that make this a common error.
I mean, I do think, I guess Phil raised it first, that there's a lot of resonance with consumers with heparin at this point. I don't know, you know, who's going to be reading this glossary, but...
Well, we really aren't depending on there being a definition here, because as far as I can see, unless I'm missing it, the only place where that phrase appears is in the implementation guidance column under somebody who had a medication error. And it's very vague what we're saying, but we're just simply giving some examples of stuff. And so I think it'd be perfectly fine to put anything we want, including insulin, anticoagulants, or any other high alert medication, and then say high alert medications include but are not limited to the medications listed by the ISMP.
Okay.
That way we don't have to make sure that we continually maintain and update our list when they change theirs.
Yeah, I think that sounds fine.
Does that make sense to everybody, listing
yeah.
those few
yeah.
and then having the ISMP, including the link listed?
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, that makes sense. It's just, okay.
This is Tejal. I had another comment on another one of the definitions, which was for healthcare setting. And I know that this was meant to include, you know, office practices, and sort of buried when it says it includes medical centers or offices and then dialysis centers, et cetera. But I just thought that the sort of the routine ambulatory physician office was a little lost in that phrasing. So I was thinking maybe we could flip that out or just reinforce that in some way, because it's such a new concept that we would be even thinking about this in the office setting that I wanted to make sure that was emphasized. Do you agree that it's sort of lost in there?
Yep.
Yeah, it's Peter. I think that's a good point, especially since we have profiled the full environment on physician offices. We should make sure it stands out.
Yep, I agree.
And you would just split that into a freestanding sentence, Tejal? Is that your suggestion?
I think I would at least not say medical centers or offices. I would at least say, you know, medical centers, comma, you know, ambulatory physician offices, comma, like just have it at least have its own little
okay.
part of that sentence, if nothing else. But probably even more, at the top when you say any licensed facility, I don't even know the answer to this. I mean, are ambulatory physician offices licensed facilities?
No.
Usually not.
If they're not performing procedures, no.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that phrase even might have to get... reword it, or, you know, we could say any licensed facility or, you know, physician office or, you know, ambulatory, you know, medical office. I don't know. I'm assuming all the ambulatory surgical centers and those have to be licensed.
They don't.
Oh, those don't either.
Yeah.
This is overly legalistic, really. And I would actually, when I'm rewriting these, I say any facility where, you know, including licensed and unlicensed facilities,
yeah.
such as, you know, hospitals, doctor's offices, pharmacies.
Yeah,
I think it could be much easier on the eyes.
Yeah, I was going to ask that about pharmacies aren't listed there, and there's a second to the last line says shops and restaurants, and I hate to think that people think of pharmacies as shops, but they certainly would be it would be understandable if they did. But increasingly, with nurses and practicing in pharmacies and minute clinics and take care clinics, they are sites of care where immunizations are given and so forth. So I don't know whether I don't mean to sound parochial, but it certainly would be possible for a serious reportable event to happen in a pharmacy where a care is being given or disease management programs are being coordinated.
I agree completely. At least in Massachusetts, pharmacists that aren't part of licensed facilities such as hospitals, so that would mean the CVSs, the Rite Aids, the Walmarts, and the Walgreens, they can give medications and aren't included in either reporting or any of the other functions. So that's exactly right.
You know, the Pandora box we're opening here is Yeah, I'm not sure. There's a lot of these definitions I would just kind of not use because it's easier to not say than to try to define. But to not get ugly about it, if you're inside the supermarket, which has embedded in it a pharmacy, and you get your shot in the pharmacy, and you're allergic to eggs, and you walk into the produce section and keel over, then we're going to get that silly argument about, are you on the grounds? You know, well, you're in a supermarket, so you're not on the grounds. But on the other hand, the pharmacy's within the supermarket, so what does that mean? And I didn't think that these guidelines were really meant to try to solve that kind of thing.
I guess my view on it is that these guidelines, early guidance, for folks like Stan and others who are trying to implement the reporting to state agencies and others, and that there will be case law that evolves from this, and frankly, that will be the subject of our next update of this list, where hopefully these definitions will sharpen up. But I have no problem with kind of putting a definition out there, recognizing that it's going to be imperfect.
Right.
Yeah, this is Cynthia. I agree with the other comments. I would suggest getting rid of the license part of this definition. I don't think that it's relevant for what the purpose of these SREs is at this point. License, simply from a legal standpoint, would suggest that they're regulated. And a lot of the areas we're looking at right now are not necessarily regulated by license.
Would it be any facility, a healthcare facility maybe, or no, just any facility?
Yeah, if you just draw a line through that one word, licensed, it helps everything a lot.
Would there be the list then, healthcare settings include but are not limited to, that follows? Would that be kept in there?
I think it should be kept in there, again, just to remind people of places like...
Well, at the risk of falling in the same trap we did with the high alert medicines, would it be unreasonable to add pharmacies to that list?
I don't think it would.
I'd like to suggest that, I guess.
Yeah, maybe that's fine.
But I might even say any facility or, office setting or something. I just don't think, a little practice thinks of themselves as a facility. Facility, to me, feels very institutional.
Right. I guess I agree with Tejal that the practices need to not get left out perception be left out.
So, means any facility or office.
Right.
Yeah.
Including a discrete unit of care within a facility, and then see how it reads.
And then in the healthcare settings include piece, kind of breaking out offices again into its own little...
Yeah, medical center, physician offices, pharmacy, yeah.
Right.
I think it could be cleaned up pretty easily and substantially the same.
Yep.
Okay, sounds like we're coming to consensus on that one, getting rid of the license and moving forward by... adding the office and pharmacy in the list. Yep. Okay. Any other comments on other terms in the glossary?
Yeah, I've got lots. Just starting at A. You knew I would. I'm sorry. Adverse. There's a lot of these that I thought could be edited a bit, and so I changed adverse to read. Adverse describes a consequence of care that results in an undesired outcome. It does not address preventability.
This is Diane. I joined late, and I apologize for that. I don't have the glossary with me. Can you, Michael, could you read what the current wording is?
Okay, so that's changed from... Adverse describes a negative consequence of care that results in unintended injury or illness, which may or may not have been preventable.
Okay.
Now, without getting all pedantic on it, a negative consequence is redundant, and unintended injury or illness adds a new term that we haven't defined, which is illness, and unintended, it doesn't matter because the issue is the outcome, it's not the intent. And so on and so on. I just get all semantic about it, but I can cut this and copy it into the thing so you can look at it.
Well, I only have my phone, so I can't.
Okay. So what I changed was an undesired outcome to me is like the nugget of what's adverse.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Does that make sense to other people?
Say it one more time.
Adverse describes a consequence of care that results in an undesired outcome. And then new sentence, it does not address preventability.
I like that.
Yeah.
Fine with me.
That's fine.
And then, you know, if you just want me to rattle on until you're sick of it.
Michael, could you hold it for just a second? If,
sure.
Besides Diane, are other people on you're on your screen? So can you see things that are typed in if people include text?
Oh, I forgot to even get the screen.
Yeah.
Well, how do I find that? I need to go back and
there's
find
a link. There's a link that you can
yeah,
click on.
Yeah, I need to find
the
original
webinar.
Email, which
yeah.
is, you know.
This is Helen. I don't see the changes that you type. So right now I only see the screen that says, we've highlighted authorized means having official permission. That's all I see right now on the screen.
Do you have the lower window open?
The text chat?
Text chat?
Yeah. Oh, no, I did not.
Yeah, that's where people are typing.
Scroll down.
Okay.
And the first thing I wanted to call attention to before we got completely far away from it was that Cynthia added her proposed definition of authorized just, you know, since we may not be on the phone together. Does that make sense to people as far as what we discussed about at the beginning of the call?
Yes.
Yeah, if that works for the lawyers, it works for me.
Oh, yep. Okay.
You too.
Good. Okay. All right. I just wondered. So hopefully everybody will be getting into the chat box if you need to. But with that, I guess we can move back to Michael. You had some other comments or suggestions. Okay.
Let's see. For associated with, I changed that to, let's see, the from. It went on, this is the old definition. Associated with means that it is reasonable to initially assume that the adverse event was due to the referenced course of care, semicolon, further investigation and or root cause analysis of the unplanned event may be needed to confirm or refute the presumed relationship. And I changed that in my mind to associated with means that an event occurred in the course of care. It does not imply a causal relationship with an outcome.
Sounds good to me, very much simpler.
Yeah, I agree, too.
Agree.
I agree, too.
My brain, you know.
This is Cynthia. Michael, these look much more succinct than what was there before, but I have a need to go back and look at them in the context of the original definition of serious preventable event before I would be comfortable.
Yeah, I fully expect that we're going to need to look at all these changes sort of independently a little bit. I wouldn't even begin to expect that I couldn't anyway vote on this today because I have too many things that I need to actually ponder.
Michael, I guess I'm a little confused. I think your substitution is certainly a lot simpler, maybe clearer, but it seems to be different than the definition that's in the, to my way of looking at it, the it's due in the definition that we have in the glossary. It says it's reasonable to initially assume that the adverse event was due to the reference course of care, and due to me does imply a causal relationship. Due.
Yes. So in a way, actually, maybe I'm disputing that's
I think you are right.
A scientific definition of associated.
Okay.
So if you parse that, and I think grammatically it's tough, but if you parse it logically, what the old way says, someone could assume that we're only going to call it associated if someone could assume that it was a part of the causal pathway. And I would allow that we could admit associated things before we even have an assumption about, or even in the absence of any assumption about, whether they're on the causal path. You know, and let that's something that could be determined later or, you know, whatever. But let's just, like we would statistically say, if we have a correlation, that's what we want to discuss. And let's ignore causation for now.
This is Diane. I'm trying to decide whether I think she's better in this case, because we very clearly define associated in a way that's consistent with the old language here, or the current language that Michael's proposing changing. We say you should assume that something is associated until you can show that it's not, which I think is consistent with the language we have now. Trying to decide if something is lost here. You're essentially saying, Michael, we should just not look at causation at all. We should not look at whether there's any correlation. But do we lose some nuance when you go to that phrasing?
Well, you do in a way. I mean, in a way, we're having a philosophical discussion about whether we should report things because they occur in our care process without making a judgment, or whether we should hold off on the report until we've made an assumed judgment, which may turn out to be wrong.
Yeah, and the way that we deal with it is to say, report it, and then if you later determine that it wasn't associated, you can unreport it. You can pull it out if you later determine that it was not associated. And we have had that happen. But I don't know if that process works everywhere. I think it's probably a little safer to say, report it, the causality, but that might also open up some interpretation issues, I think, for some facilities.
Yeah, Diane, Cindy, I agree with your comment. That my experience is what yours is, and that is we would report it and withdraw it if we did not find a causal relationship. And I think that it becomes difficult to suggest that an event should or could be prevented if there's no indice of causation. But I'm not, at the same time, I'm still not sure that I like this better from a legal standpoint and a negligence standpoint or not. So
yeah.
I'm going to have to, like you said, Michael, think more about it and look back at the original definition.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, this will take some thinking. I was going to give you an example of patient death or serious injury associated with a medication error. So if we just use that as a test case, if the death or injury with a medication error occurred in the course of care, do you want that reported, or do you want someone to first make a judgment that the medication error caused the death or injury?
Well, I think caused is different than associated with, though. I mean,
I agree completely with that. I think cause is completely different than associated with it.
And I think what we would want, and the guidance we try and give, is report it. If you later determine that the death was not associated with that medication error, then you can pull it out. But I know that we do have facilities that wait until they know reporting it. They wait until they get the autopsy results, and they report it at the time if there's a determination that there was some relationship between the med error and the death. But ideally, what we want is the report first before the determination is made. It just doesn't always happen that way. But I would be careful about use associated with interchangeably.
Yeah, that's my point. That's why I rewrote it, so that you don't have to assume anything about cause. If they died and there was a medication, you know, it's an and with no presumption. They died, there was a medication error, report it. And we'll argue about cause later. Or not, you know, take the other approach.
The existing language does that too, right?
Yeah.
It is kind of a philosophical question. I'm okay with tabling it, and we hash it out when we each look at the, you know, final draft of the glossary.
Okay, well, I'm not going to fall on my sword over this because, you know, this is just A, and I have, like, all the way down to Z, but...
Well, let me stop you there because, you know, I'm concerned that process-wise, we've got 25 minutes left.
Yeah.
I want to do this glossary right, and I think this is an incredibly inefficient way to do it. My sense is that what would be useful, that would speed this along, is actually if you could, Michael, if you could forward to Lindsay kind of your proposals, we could speak off that, and I think we could probably move more efficiently. I don't see how we're going to not do that in another phone call at this point in time. But it seems to me that we probably would be better off process-wise by having your list, and I think others may also have more changes to the glossary, because I'm afraid if we go one by one, we're not going to get through to anything else. Or maybe we should just go one by one and wrestle to this to the ground. So I'm open to either approach. I think in either case, we're not going to get through things today.
I think we should do this as a shared document edit offline.
I agree.
I agree, too.
Yes.
I agree, too.
Agreed.
Well, why don't we do that? What I ask you, Michael, and others who have other, I have a couple other things I'd like to put forward to the group on the glossary, that we get them to Lindsay, and if we can put a time frame on getting them back electronically, feedback electronically to Lindsay, and that we might be able to do this one offline.
What do you mean by a shared document? Can you describe that process real quickly?
Well, yeah. I sort of had the fantasy that if we all sent our edits to Lindsay and she sort of collated them under the sections for each definition, that we could read all the comments together.
Yeah, I think we can just use track changes or add comments.
I wanted to be sure there wasn't some exotic new electronic technique of doing this, like a Wikipedia type of thing. So, okay.
Well, now that you mention it.
I think that we need to be a little bit careful about making huge radical changes at this point, unless, you know, people out there have expressed confusion with regards to the current definition. The big push, for, not that we don't want a perfect document eventually, but I think that the important thing here is to expand the use of the SREs to other sites and not necessarily cause confusion where we already have effective reporting by changing all the definitions.
Well, I agree with that. This is Diane. Do you think unless there's a lack of clarity or some ambiguity in the definition, or we've made a fundamental change in how we're interpreting something, we should probably not change. We could probably simplify wording all over the place, but
right. We
may not do that necessarily.
So we'll get these to Lindsay.
Yes, I think that's what people had agreed. If you have proposed changes, get them in writing electronically to Lindsay.
Besides the ones that have already been made, not
yes,
the,
besides not, the ones we've already agreed on.
Okay, good.
Mm-hmm. Moving forward.
So perhaps we can move. The next remaining item we had was when an individual becomes a patient or under care. So this is also within the.
We had a lot of discussion on that on the last call, right? That was our.
I didn't notice a piece of text to read about that. What did?
Yeah, I'm trying to follow along on the screen share, and I'm not sure where we're.
I don't think we had text to respond to on that one.
Okay.
And I should give you all a heads up. I'm up in northern Minnesota in an area where my cell phone is probably going to conk out pretty soon, so I may be a little bit in and out of this call here forward.
I wasn't on the previous call, but I know that there are some people, and I just was in a meeting a few hours ago where people really don't like this term patient at all. They call it clients, and there's all kinds of stuff. Was that the, sort of the nature of the discussion?
No, it was more about the timing of when.
Oh, okay.
It was more about...
and Stan and I had looked into this a little bit. It was more about, you know, EMTALA defines a setting, or you're on the premises of a setting when you're within a certain number of yards.
Right.
And we were talking about whether we should have a clear definition of when someone becomes a patient. So it's not just you are on the grounds of a facility, because that may not be the right criterion for certain events. But we wanted to get closer, I think, to something like when you're under the care of a provider, or when you've sort of entered into that care relationship, as opposed to just when you've set foot on the ground.
Yeah, the way this came up was under sexual assault, among maybe a couple others. But to use the example, sexual abuse or assault on a patient within or on the grounds while under care in the healthcare setting.
Yeah, and I think for us in Minnesota, it's come up with falls as well, where we had a case where somebody fell in the parking lot. So technically on the grounds of the setting per EMTALA, but not necessarily something that we would try and capture through our system.
So this is Duran. I was looking at the additional specifications under the patient protection events and think that that wording is very not helpful there, where it says that this includes events that occur after the individual presents him or herself for care to any member of the healthcare team who is or has been trained in basic patient assessments. So I actually favor and would throw out, what if we suggested the use of the words registered in a facility? So once you register, you're declaring yourself as a patient. You are in the system. And, you know, the registrar is not capable or trained to care for you. So it wouldn't meet the current additional specifications. But if you're registered, then you, as in a healthcare organization, have some need to watch that patient. So I'll throw that out as possible language.
That makes me nervous, because I'm not sure when you become unregistered. And also, just think of the ambulatory setting that where I live. Not everybody registers in the same way. Same, you know. You're going to get arguments about were they really registered? They only signed half their name.
Well, the current specification is very loose. It says to any member of the healthcare team who is or has been trained in basic patient assessment.
Yeah,
that's worse.
Yeah, I agree that that's a problem. You know, but in my simple-minded way, the way I would deal with this would be to try to define it by boxing it in with examples of when they are under care and when they're not.
Yeah, maybe that's the way to go with this. We tried to come up with something similar to that phrasing, because registered didn't really work, and we wanted to make sure we could capture, you know, an emergency department setting or things where you might still be visible to the care team and still there's some sort of an obligation even if you haven't actually, you know, checked in or been registered. And we didn't feel that just having a secretary at the front desk check you in was sufficient. There had to be some sort of contact with the care team in some way, whether it's someone doing an initial triage or an initial assessment or something.
So we had cases here in Philadelphia in the past year where patients have died in the waiting room of the emergency department after registering.
Yeah,
and so it kind of begs the question of what responsibility did that hospital have?
It must have a long waiting time.
Well, yeah, unfortunate. Then they had their watch robbed.
The city of brotherly love.
Yeah.
Well, the other problem with this is there's no end point. So once they've presented once, you know, and then they walk out and they go to Arby's 5 hours later, and then, you know.
They currently registered.
Yeah, no, I think.
We don't deregister them when we discharge. You know, when you're done with your flu shot, you just walk into the produce section. So, are you still registered, or did you somehow become deregistered?
Excuse me, everybody. This is Sally. I have to hop off. I apologize for that. And at this point, I have a sneaking suspicion we're going to be doing another call, and I'm sure that Peter and Lindsay, you guys will let me know about scheduling.
Thanks for your help.
Thank you.
We'll get something going. Yeah.
Okay. Bye.
This is Diane. I would say to Mike, if we come up with a definition of when someone becomes a patient, we have to have a definition of when you're no longer a patient for that particular episode of care. So
I agree.
We have to have something that when you're discharged from the hospital or when you leave the clinic, And maybe the best way, since there's no universal that's going to cover all settings, maybe we do give a few examples in the guidance for each setting. So we describe what we mean when this is an ED or a hospital or an ambulatory setting or something else. So we have to cover both ends of it.
Also, I'd add that to the glossary, because that's the one thing I really miss in the glossary is that definition. Could be useful.
A definition of patient?
No, under care.
Oh, under care, yeah. But I think we probably have to have one for patient, too, because we use
So the proposal is that we would not have this as an additional specification. Instead, we just have implementation guidance examples for each setting.
Yes.
And in terms of the end point, you know, the other issue comes up is when does somebody officially leave?
And again, I think that's going to be clearer in some settings than others. But it sounds like we're in general agreement that we feel that you become a patient at the point when you have some contact with somebody, whether it's a point of registration or a point of, you know, a check-in or triage, and you cease being a patient for that particular episode of care. At the point you leave the clinic, leave the hospital, you know, are formally discharged, something of that nature, right? We just need to get the specific wording for it.
Yeah, that does it with me. And I don't mind if we would even acknowledge that there is no uniform definition that crosses all care settings.
Well, I think the way to do that is to use examples under implementation guidance then. So in some settings, it would be registration. In others, it would be when you present yourself to a member of the healthcare team who can do basic patient assessment. Are there any other ways that you would become part of, you become under care?
Well, in telemedicine, we got a whole other set of things, you know. I think we have to admit that on cruise ships and when the EMTs pull up to your car and, you know, transfers, there's all kinds of things that I can imagine because I have a garish imagination. So I would sort of like to box it in with examples and then sort of make an annotation that it seems impossible to get a comprehensive definition.
So we could say there is no single definition of under care. Here are some examples for various settings.
Yeah.
And I think what that's going to leave us with is in 3 or 4 years we'll be coming back to our friends from Minnesota and Massachusetts and elsewhere and asking you how we can sharpen this up based on your kind of case law.
We'll do our best.
Yeah, I think that's what's going to happen.
I do too. Okay, well, why don't we try that? And I guess if Peter, you folks can take a stab at revising that, we'll try to go with that.
We'll have a go at it. Melinda and Lindsay and I will tap away.
And I think you and I have officially been labeled guinea pigs.
I think so.
The next is for us to talk about the end of surgery issue. And this one we had a fair amount of discussion on one of our very first calls. And after a pretty long discussion, I think we got to this wheels out definition, but it was one that I wanted to make sure that people didn't have additional comments on or were comfortable. They were comfortable with where we're at on this. And I'm not sure if you can put anything up on the screen share for us to look at in terms of referencing this. But again, we had a pretty long discussion on this at the very beginning.
This is Peter, and partly why we're doing like a double or even a triple check on this one is that there is an awful lot of attention on this particular topic because of the implications it carries for retention of foreign bodies, and there's a lot of folks kind of holding their breath waiting for the correct definition in their mind to come through. So we want to, while all points of this document are important, this is one in particular that's under the microscope quite closely.
Well, where do we define this? Again, that's not in the glossary, but does it show up in the in the matrix somewhere?
It's in the glossary under the term surgery ends.
Right.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Is there a place for it in the implementation guidance as well?
Yes.
Yeah, we should put it in the this is a very common question.
I don't know. I mean, I don't have the language right in front of me, but I know from our discussion before, the wheels out definition is certainly closer to how we look at it here in Minnesota. We had originally been looking at it at the point of closure, and wheels out seems to be closer to what we're trying to capture.
Yeah, so this the current definition that's on the screen here really focuses more on closure as opposed to wheels out. And again, we heard practically speaking that wheels out may be much more practical to implement.
I agree with the wheels out as more practical to implement too. You know, I think the part of this definition here is that it talks about the post anesthesia recovery unit. I think that may be important. I mean, you may have to send someone to CT scan, for instance, to make sure about things, and then bring them back. You know, I think that closure is not necessarily the best endpoint.
And we had a formal definition of wheels out, and I think it came from the anesthesiologist, but I think we ought to put that in here.
We had one for Minnesota too that I think I'd passed along. But
yeah.
So if we can resuscitate those and amend the surgery ends, I think that we'll be able to tackle that one.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other comment on the end of surgery? Okay. The next one was time frame for central line associated bloodstream infections.
Yeah, this is Peter. We've got 48 hours on there, and classifying when the CLABSI occurs and when exactly the diagnosis is made and attribution, et cetera, is complicated. I know this was an externally submitted SRE, but I just wanted us to just question the time frame component, recognizing that while CLABSI is au courant, very topical and popular, are we jumping too quickly, too far ahead with the right amount of, or the incorrect amount of evidence to support this?
This is Diane. I know I've gotten some questions about this one from folks here in Minnesota, and I am just so not an infection control expert that I don't feel like I can weigh in, but is it consistent with how CDC defines CLABSI timeframes for reporting into NHSN?
I think that's a great question, and I also think that 48 hours may be really too soon to figure out attribution.
I agree. Yeah,
I agree as well.
That was the feedback I hear from people in Minnesota, was that at 48 hours, it's too soon for attribution. But I tried to see if it's consistent with the CDC's definition, and I don't have an answer to that. It feels like if we are going to add it, we should make sure that we are.
I would think that anything more than 48 hours, you're going to have a different attribution problem, which is the maintenance of the line. The closer to the line insertion, the more that you get a positive gram, a positive bacteremia, the more likely it becomes associated with a line insertion, which has been shown to be preventable. Maintenance of the line is a separate issue, and greater than 48 hours, you're going to be dealing with maintenance issues as opposed to insertion issues.
I just found something on the web from Rhode Island, Department of Health, that uses 48 hours.
Can we check with NHSN and see what's required there? I know that there's people that are already doing it.
Actually, their definition is a little different from ours. I can copy this here, because what they say is they're primary bloodstream infections in patients that had a central line in place within 48 hours before the development of the infection.
Well, that's hooking VSI to the line.
Right, that's trying to kind of imply the causation there. I think Peter's original point is well taken. On the one hand, I think in some senses it would be tough politically to come out with a new list of SREs and remain silent on central line-associated bloodstream infections. On the other hand, I think the practicality of implementing this is currently limited, is written, is going to be awfully difficult. I mean, I guess it begs the question, is this right? Is it ready for prime time?
Well, and is this the right mechanism for it? I mean, there are other state reporting systems that capture bloodstream infections, and I wonder, is this something that is already captured under other reports? That may or may not be a criterion for excluding it here, though.
Yeah. Is there another group that's starting the hospital-acquired infections? Am I remembering that correctly?
CMS is about to look at hospital-acquired infections, too, so this may be actually a really redundant, and it's such a, you know, it's such a difficult thing to sort of nail down. You know, it may be the poster child right now. I think we probably need to be careful.
I think what we could do is there's no reason why we couldn't put in the text of the report saying that we consider this, but we are our concern is non-uniformity of definitions. My worst nightmare practically would be that there are three or four different definitions out there, and we have to report differently based on different definitions to different groups. We would not be moving the world forward if we went to that place.
Yeah, that was here in Minnesota. Is if we're going to do it as an SRE, we should at a minimum be consistent with CDC, and we would hope evolving state reporting systems are also consistent with CDC, but I don't know if that's always the case. But you certainly want to prevent a situation where you have five different ways.
Yeah.
And however Medicare has to define this and implement this, that's going to dominate. That's going to dominate.
Yeah, this is Peter. You know, there is a very aggressive federal agency-based HAI action plan, of which CLABSI is right up front. CMS is moving to CLABSI-based reporting in 2011. We are endorsing a measure on CLABSI as we speak that is based on NHSN, and then, as has been stated, the state-based requirements vary out there. And the last point is, while some places are saying they've gone 1-2 years without a CLABSI, the reality is the majority of places are still struggling with this. And so it may be a little premature to put it out as an SRE at this point, given there's a multitude of other reporting.
And we can make that point in our response to this.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, we're going to take a lot of noise on the public comment if we leave it up as is.
Yeah.
That's okay. Yep. All right.
Quick time checker.
Okay, I'll send you a PDF reference at the CDC that defines it.
Quick time check. Are we going to wrap up as advertised or keep
going? I think we need to, yeah. And so I think that brings us to having to halt for public comment. We actually still have, it looks at least three or four additional to cover. And I guess the real question, and perhaps Sally, myself, Lindsay, Peter, Melinda, can really kind of brainstorm and see how much of this we think we can do electronically offline with you versus having to bring the group together again. I'm not sure, is there any reason, in terms of public comments, though, and being true to the consensus development process, that we ought to do this as an additional phone call? So I defer to you on that, Peter.
I was just re-looking at these four bullets critically, and I believe we can manage all of those electronically through a SurveyMonkey, and any public comment or inputs could be incorporated during the public comment period of the document itself.
That's what I would propose to move forward. Is there anyone who has an objection to trying to do that?
No.
No.
Okay.
That would allow us to process this common document that we discussed earlier on the glossary, set up a SurveyMonkey for these four, and then close out our work.
So hearing no other objections, then I propose we move forward with that. And that leaves, Peter, you need to do a quick check for a public comment?
Yes, thank you, Greg. And operator, if you're around, if you could just see if there's anyone in the other line and whether or not there are questions for us.
Absolutely. For those on the phone, if you'd like to ask a question, it is star one at this time. Star one for questions. And we have no questions in the queue.
Okay. That would make public comment closed. Thank you.
Thank you to the group. This is in some ways not with a bang but a whimper, because there's a bit of unfinished work here. But I do want to add my word of incredibly deep, sincere thanks to all of you for helping us move this forward. And this is, I think, when you see the end product, you've been immersed in the sausage maker of process for the last several months. But when you see the end product, I know this will be something that you will be quite proud to be associated with. So thank you all, and again, thank you to the NQF staff, and we look forward to clearing this up electronically and moving forward.
Yeah, it's Peter, and I'd like to echo those same deep and sincere thanks. We'll follow up with timely further electronic work, and we'll certainly keep you all informed as the process of this moves along. And if there are any comments or concerns or issues in the interim, don't hesitate to contact myself or Lindsay or Melinda. And we will have one or two more calls as we come past the public comment and do our revisions process. But I think our end product is going to be pretty strong, and the field will react to it, I think, mostly favorably. But thank you again. And we'll call the end of the call at this time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.